I'm Mark Labberton, president of Fuller Theological Seminary. Welcome to Conversing. We're really glad to be able to welcome Jacqueline Fuller today. She's the president of Google.org and Google Foundation. And her work before that had been with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, where she was leading their efforts in global health advocacy. So it really is a great joy to welcome you, and I look forward to this conversation.
Thanks, Mark. Great to be here.
Jacqueline, I think it might be helpful for our listeners just to hear a bit about your story. In some ways, if you're a person inclined to philanthropy, the thought that you get to be a person that works for the Gates Foundation and Google.org is like a dream come true. You have come to the end of the rainbow. There is a pot of gold and you get to give it away. Like, what could be a better thing than that? So tell us how it came about that you even got to either of these jobs and a little bit about what it was that formed you for work in philanthropy, do you think?
You know, Mark, it's funny. I do get a reaction from a lot of people when they hear my job. They say, oh, Jacqueline, you have the best job in the world. That's so amazing. And I do feel very, very grateful for the position that I have and the work that I get to do day in and day out. But I think what a lot of people don't understand about philanthropy is that for every yes that you get to say to that wonderful community partner who's working on the front lines and doing heroic work, you have to say no to at least 99 other people.
Yes.
And so it is a job where you spend the majority of your time saying that you unfortunately cannot support this great social entrepreneur or this wonderful effort going on because it just doesn't fit within your priorities.
Right.
But I came to this wonderful job and the Gates Foundation prior to that. My background was in public policy, actually. I had, in college, had started out as a arms control major in international relations and thought that that was going to be my focus and got quite down the pike and ended up going to a arms control simulation course in France that I did and spent some time in Europe. And I just remember one day looking around the room and seeing a lot of very wealthy, very powerful people, mostly men, and realizing, you know, as important as nuclear deterrence is and the effort at arms control, this is a problem that we are going to solve because it affects rich people as well as poor people. But at the same time, I had begun volunteering in Watts in Los Angeles, a low-income community. And I realized when I looked around the room at my gatherings where people were working on social justice and racial reconciliation and economic opportunity, that we didn't have the powerful and the educated and the privileged. And, you know, we didn't have anywhere near the number of resources or attention going into that. And so I made a decision in college, much to the chagrin of my parents. I announced that I was going to major in urban poverty and public policy, and that became my focus. So that was my background, actually. I did a bit of social economic research and worked in public policy, worked for the government for a couple years, got a degree in public policy and community development, and then after some time with my kids, started at Gates.
It's just an amazing story, really. First of all, I think it's profound, of course, that from my point of view, you would have this kind of illumination, really, in the contrast between the two social settings, between the arms control conversations and the social justice, racial and social opportunity, economic opportunity conversation, and how that contrast stood out to you. What were the things that you think helped you to see that so clearly? Because I think not everyone would necessarily see or be gripped by that contrast. Why did that happen for you?
Well, I had been thinking about my career and my life and, you know, where I wanted to invest this one, you know, precious and crazy life and talents that I had been given and thought, well, where could I have a singular impact? You know, where could I, as who I am, make the most impact? And while I was really drawn to arms control and games theory and the thought that goes behind effective negotiations and all the technical aspects of arms control, I realized I was just one of many very talented people who were working on that and were energized by that. And frankly, where there were incentives for that kind of work. But the time that I spent volunteering to help with community government, state government in LA, or working in the communities, or doing the social welfare policy research, you know, I realized looking around the room, for example, that there weren't the technologists, there weren't the researchers, the folks who were doing economic regression studies, for example, were a lot were focused on Wall Street and other aspects of financial policy. And very few of them were doing or interested in doing the kind of social policy research and econometrics that I was interested in. So I thought that was an area where I could have more of a differential impact.
Right. So in part, it was gap theory. I mean, there was a gap and there was the potential of being able to make a significant contribution in an area that was being underserved. Is that a fair way of casting it?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, one of the things that I've been so grateful for over the years in knowing you as a friend is that you're a person who cares deeply, in part because of your own Christian faith and how that is informed acts of conscience, whether they're social conscience or personal conscience. How did that figure into this mix for you?
Yeah. So, you know, I was raised in a very good and moral home, very giving and loving parents and family, but not a church-going family, not Christian. And I was exposed to Christianity as a teenager through the ministry of Young Life and had really loving, supportive, amazing leaders who modeled for me what it looks like to be a good Christian and to walk in that faith. So as a new, excited Christian, as a teenager, I remember thinking, well, I should read the Bible because I think that's what you're supposed to do. And so I sat down and I read through the Bible, you know, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus. That was a killer for a new believer wading into Leviticus. And literally just read the Bible through, you know, page to page. And I remember after doing that, that I stepped back and I thought, okay, well, clearly God loves me. God loves people and wants the best for our lives. And God loves the poor and expects us to differentially care about the poor and to really think about the fatherless and the oppressed. And that's a really important part about what it means to be a Christian. And so it was really from that reading that I first started thinking about these issues and thought, well, if that's the case, then what's the most effective way to go about doing that? But that was really where it started.
Wow. It's a great seedbed. And I know from other conversations and things that we can talk about today that keeps recurring to you in various ways as your life and work continues. So give us a little window into the time that you were at the Gates Foundation, and then we'll switch to Google Oregon. Talk about what's happening now.
So I joined the Gates Foundation when it was just a nascent organization. It had just started. And in fact, I was just coming off of taking some time off to be with my babies. I had two daughters, Hosanna and Sophie, back to back after grad school. And I had done some part-time work, but in looking for my full-time work, I had read an article in a magazine where Bill Gates had been interviewed and said that he was going to give the majority of his fortune away, and he was going to give it to help the poorest of the poor. And I just thought, I'm sold. Hire me. I'll help you. What a great vision. And yes, absolutely. And the Gates Foundation at that point was in sort of stealth mode. And so the article was very veiled in all of its references and just said that it was a small group of folks. They were working out of a temporary office above a pizza shop in Redmond, Washington. So I drove around Redmond and looked at all the pizza shops and looked for one with an office building above it, and then went to that place and looked at the mailboxes and sort of deduced which one might be the Gates Foundation. None of them were labeled Gates Foundation. And I would just go there every day and I would put my resume and a cover letter into the mailbox. And, you know, eventually I started getting rejection letters emailed back to me. And so I would pivot a little bit on the value I could offer them and, you know, do another one. And finally, Jack Ferris, who was one of the handful of folks working there, emailed me and said, I will meet with you, Jacqueline, for 15 minutes at Starbucks in Redmond if you promise to never bother us again. And I thought...
And this is like, really a true story, Jacqueline, right?
True story. 100% true story. And it's like that moment in Dumb and Dumber when she says, you know, basically, I wouldn't go out with you in a million years. And he's like, wait, you mean I have a chance? I was like, oh, I have 15 minutes.
Right, right.
So I met with him, and bless his heart, after our conversation, he was like, well, this is not how I thought this was going to go, but actually, I think you're really interesting, and we could use your help on some things. But none of this sort of econometrics or advocacy or other stuff you're talking about, but we could use a writer because we need someone to write our first brochure. So can you do that? And so that's how I started.
Wow. Wow. Amazing. Now, you had various roles there and you saw it really scale up in a very significant way. Tell us a little about what that was like to see something begin in such a nascent way and then develop. I mean, it must have been exciting and amazing to watch it unfold.
Yeah, it was really phenomenal. And one of the things that I really give Bill and Melinda Gates a lot of credit for is they had a very crystal clear moral foundation for their work. And that was that all lives have equal value. And they took that proposition, all lives have equal value, and then asked the question, well, if that's true, and if all lives really are equal, then what's the most effective way to help save lives and make lives better? And from that, mathematically, you can pretty quickly come to improving global health and to solutions such as improving vaccination. You know, they were just appalled when they learned how many kids were dying from vaccine-preventable diseases. So that, I think that has stayed very constant through the years of the Gates Foundation, that laser focus on all lives having equal value. I think they've pivoted a bit as they've thought about what are the best solutions for that, particularly in their education work in U.S. high schools, learning, trying some things and figuring out what's going to be most impactful there. But their vision really hasn't changed.
Now, one of the things that's behind the development of the Gates Foundation was this period of time when obviously Microsoft was explosively growing. It had already become a dominant world force. And there were articles in the press about how it was really Bill Gates' parents, and at times I think it seems to have been particularly his mother, and then particularly Melinda, who became goads for his philanthropic vision, having been principally a technologist and a person oriented toward the business side of things, to then shift toward the philanthropic side of things was at least something that there were a lot of articles written at the time about whether Bill Gates would ever become a philanthropist. Now, of course, that seems like ancient history, and you would almost say that he is more known or as known as a philanthropist as he's known as a technologist. So are there things that you have learned and observed in that movement with this transition for Bill Gates himself or Bill and Melinda Gates about how philanthropy grew out of this kind of central conviction that all lives have equal value? That's not the reputation sometimes of any given business, Microsoft or otherwise. They don't tend to think in those terms. So to shift from those terms to then this deeply human-centric, all lives have equal value, that's an extraordinary philanthropic value. I'm just wondering how you observe that transition.
Well, I think it's perfectly reasonable that people were skeptical at first when the Gates Foundation was first starting and was announced, because quite honestly, a lot of corporate philanthropy, personal philanthropy is really just marketing dressed up as giving. And it's really not either well-resourced or it's really not taken seriously. And really, the person is not quite often investing their time and their brains and their network and their talents and their skills. So I think it's reasonable that people would approach a new philanthropic effort with some skepticism. And I think you saw a lot of that skepticism. And I give Patty Stonecipher a lot of credit. She was the first CEO of the Gates Foundation when was really there the first decade or so. And, you know, she really inculcated into all of us, especially in the beginning, humble, mindful. Humble, mindful. We're new to this space. We're learning. We're standing on the shoulders of giants. We're here to fund the true heroes, who are the scientists and the researchers and the community health workers who are on the front lines. And she really set the tone that I think is super important, because funders are such a privileged bunch, and we can, if the natural forces are for us to become isolated and really separate. And so I really give her a lot of credit. She also made sure that we knew that the efforts that we were doing were not about getting good PR and that we should just really focus on what was most effective from the vantage point of improving health and well-being for the poorest of the poor. So I think the skepticism was reasonable in the beginning, but I can tell you I would roll my eyes, especially after, say, like 5 or 6 years. I remember being in India with the Gates Foundation and someone saying, oh, I think this, you know, $300 million HIV prevention initiative is really just about, you know, buying Microsoft customers or good PR or something. And I was like, really? Because I can think of a lot more effective ways to get good PR or to, you know, perhaps have a better brand associated with Microsoft rather than doing HIV prevention with high-risk behavior groups such as men who have sex with men and intravenous drug users and commercial sex workers and truck drivers. Those are the groups we're working with. You know, like, you're really aimed at improving your image. I'm not sure you go into this work.
There was one moment that I know that you had, you were responsible for lots of different things that you did for them when you were involved with global health advocacy, but one of those things had to do with diarrhea. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about a particular trip that I think you were responsible for.
Well, another thing that I really give Bill and Melinda a lot of credit for is that they're very serious philanthropists in the sense that they really want firsthand knowledge of what they're doing. They don't want to rely on just reading books, although they do read and devour a ton of data and material, but they also wanted to make sure that they rolled up their sleeves and actually visited countries in the developing world and really got to know the people on the front line. So one of my jobs was to bring Bill and Melinda organized trips, week-long trips, where we would go to places like India or South Africa or Mozambique or Botswana or Kenya or Pakistan and really spend time to understand the issue. And in fact, I was with Bill Gates the first time he ever went into a low-income community in the developing world, and that was in India back in like 1999 or 2000. But one of the later trips that we did, so we would organize these trips around a specific theme that they wanted to understand a bit better. And one of them was, I think, officially called the sanitation tour, but really was all about understanding diarrhea, which is a leading cause of death for children under 5 in the developing world. And what is seen as just pretty much a nuisance for us in the rich world with our children, with our babies and our infants is actually a leading cause of death. So understanding what were the precursors leading to diarrhea, how did you treat it? How could we train and empower mothers? How do you use things like oral rehydration solution and understanding some of the diseases associated with it? So we organized this tour, and I remember we went to see a hospital called ICDDRB in Bangladesh, and it's a diarrhea hospital. And Bill and Melinda, and particularly Bill, was so excited to go to this place because they had really pioneered some of the treatments for diarrhea. So for example, we went there and they had these cots, these medical cots that were very simple metal with like a waterproof plastic mat. And then the bed had a hole in the middle and the mat had a hole in the middle. So the patient could literally just lay on that. You put a bucket underneath them and that's how you dealt with something like cholera and with rapid dehydration and diarrhea. So yeah, you know, we would do tours at places like that where they really wanted to see these frontline, you know, solutions and then think about how to scale them.
You know, we've talked about a lot of things in this podcast around conversing, but it's just so amazing to think that it's a podcast that involves a discussion about Bill and Melinda Gates, that it's in that context that we talk about the diarrhea tour. I just love that.
And in fact, they later created the Gates Award for Global Health, which was, you know, the idea was to have a very prestigious award that would go to excellent work within the global health realm. And they gave the first award to ICDDRB. And I remember sitting around the table with a bunch of sort of PR and marketing types who were like, wait, we're giving it to what? And yeah, but, you know, it wasn't about what's flashy. It's about what works.
I'm Mark Laberton. You're listening to Conversing, a production of Fuller Studio. So then you made the shift. What drew you from Gates, which seems like such an ideal place to get to work, albeit with the challenges of saying no that you mentioned earlier? You wanted to come to a new entity that was also just beginning at the time that you went there. Tell us about that.
So I had been at the Gates Foundation for, gosh, a good 8 years, including a year living in India. I had had a wonderful career there, met some of my best friends, most respected peers, but had started to sense a bit of a, you know, hitting a ceiling and not really growth opportunities for me to try new things or do new things or take more leadership. And at the same time, I had also gotten very interested in this world of corporate philanthropy. And, you know, if you take a step back and look at all of the giving in the U.S., from individuals, foundations, companies, everyone, you know, it's north of $375 billion a year. So it's a huge industry. But of that giving, only 5% comes from corporations, which is actually quite shocking.
Right.
And Larry Page, one of the co-founders of Google, he likes to say, most of us will spend most of our time working for a company. And so let's think about how to make that time the most enjoyable, the most impactful, and to make the work of the company achieve not just profit, but making the world a better place. So I really think that makes a lot of sense, right? If most people are going to spend most of their time in a company, how do we think about how we structure companies and how we think about what their goal is and their objective?
Right.
Is it really all about maximizing shareholder value? Or is it about maximizing shareholder value and making the world better and creating a healthy place for workers? So
right.
I think that really intrigued me. I had started thinking about that. And about the same time, I heard about this crazy little startup within Google called Google.org.
Was it above a pizza place?
No, they had their own pizza.
Of course, silly me. Of course they had their own pizza.
Because they were part of a tech company.
Indeed.
So a little bit different setup.
Yes.
But very similar in the sense that it was still very much a startup, just a handful of people really just at the beginning of figuring out what their strategy was, how they were going to operate. But Larry and Sergey had in their letter from the founders, before the company went public, they had written into their first letter to prospective shareholders. They said, Google is not a conventional company and we don't intend to become one. And part of that is dedicating 1% of net profit each year to philanthropy and setting up Google.org. So I knew, okay, Google's really serious about this. They're putting real resources and they're thinking about not just the money, not just the resources that Google can give, but also Google itself, its employees, its products. And, you know, the Gates Foundation, of course, has huge resources and is very generous and has given so much money. But it's Bill and Melinda's private philanthropy. It's separate from Microsoft. And so you never really sort of saw, well, what would happen if you also had engineers and technologists? So I thought that was also a really interesting proposition.
Yes. Absolutely. So I understand that now you give away about $150 million a year. Is that right?
Yeah.
And give us just sort of a sweeping set of summaries about kind of the categories that most of that goes to.
Sure. I think at the top level, Google.org's unique, you know, in the same way that I try to figure out as an individual, how can I have the most differential impact? As a company, I think you have to ask yourself the same question, which is not just how much can Google give, but how can we operate as a philanthropy in a way that provides the most value for humanity? And one of the things we came to pretty early on is that we have a unique value add when it comes to funding technology and innovation, and then also providing our Googlers, our workers, our employees to come alongside our investments in our nonprofit partners and to also help to create the initiatives and create the projects. So we emphasize technology and innovation. We look for ways where we can provide not just money, but our Googlers, our products, our reach as well. And then the focus areas where we tend to operate are education, particularly in developing countries, digital skills and other approaches to help ensure everybody's participating in economic opportunity. And then finally, thinking about inclusion, making sure that society is inclusive. And under inclusion, our biggest effort is around racial justice.
So I'm curious, I love this idea that I've been taking with for a number of years about the way that Google's trying to both be philanthropic as well as to stimulate and create a culture of philanthropy, which is partly what you're saying about the way that people at all levels of the company are invited into the enterprise. Is that fair to describe it that way?
Yeah, exactly. Googlers are a very philanthropic bunch. Our employee base is very motivated by the opportunity to make the world better. So they want to be excellent at their jobs. They want to be great technologists or great marketers or whatnot. And they also really want to change the world. So part of our thinking is, how do we empower our employees to pursue their own passions within philanthropy? And how do we also then engage them in the work of Google.org? So in terms of unleashing their own potential as philanthropists, we provide $6,000 each year as a matching grant. So any employee can donate to the cause of their choice, the charity of their choice, eligible nonprofits globally, and we'll match that dollar for dollar up to $6,000. And that costs us, you know, north of $50 million a year, but we look at that as a way for us to extend our philanthropy and to make really good decisions about local community partners, because our Googlers in neighborhoods around the world are making those decisions.
Is that $50 million inside the $150 that you give away each year, or is that in addition to that? It is.
Yeah.
So almost a third is really set by the agenda of your employees.
Exactly.
Yeah,
so if they're passionate about breast cancer and they've researched and they're putting their money behind Charity A, we're going to back that.
Just as a footnote, I'm just curious, have you ever done a study of the overall philanthropy of Google employees and what all they give to and what the total is of their philanthropy, or just the portion that's related to the matched giving?
We only know the portion that they donate through our internal systems.
Yeah.
So we don't know what they do on their own. And a lot of folks like me will donate to, you know, groups like breast cancer research that are matched by Google. And then, you know, I donate to my church or to Christian orgs, which we don't match if the primary focus of the org is religious education. We'll match it if a church or a religious org is providing something like a soup kitchen, for example.
Yes, yes.
So I think it understates by quite a bit the amount of total philanthropy that
exactly.
folks are doing. But
yeah.
what we do know is that Googlers are very supportive of education. That's the number one topic that they give to.
Right.
Both in their local neighborhoods and also global organizations. And they also tend to fund groups who are using technology or innovation in clever ways. So they're more likely than the average Joe to back a group that is trying an approach that uses data, that uses technology to help address problems.
Well, it's a fantastically wonderful catalyst for this. I'm wondering, how do you see it having changed? What are the most critical challenges you think an enterprise like Google.org is facing, given the needs of the world and the philanthropic approach that you've been putting together over the last few years?
We've changed many times since .org started. And in fact, one of the things I had learned when I came to Google is tech culture. And a big part of that is this launch and iterate approach, which is the idea that you want to do your research, of course, and you're going to make a data-driven decision and do all of the analysis and really understand best in breed players and the landscape and whatnot. But the idea that you then go ahead and fund and support and then measure results rigorously and then pivot and move from there. So it's a much more iterative approach, fast moving, and very comfortable with taking informed risk.
Right.
Which I love, because I think philanthropic capital should really be risk capital.
I think that that fits, especially in a Silicon Valley culture. It fits in our culture in North America in many, many ways. How does that intersect with dramatically different cultural settings where that kind of approach is almost the antithesis of some cultures in the world? Do you find that that's an issue or not particularly?
You know, it's funny, Mark. The antithesis to that sort of risk capital, move fast, launch and iterate, look at data, I don't see it really as countercultural based on geography. It's almost more sectoral.
Uh-huh, right.
I think a lot of traditional nonprofits have a hard time with that kind of approach,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
more so than, say, philanthropy in France versus philanthropy in Brazil.
I guess I'm just struck by the fact that, you know, the sort of slow turtle-like approach to philanthropic giving has been, I think, much more common in cultures that even have an instinct for philanthropy, which isn't a global phenomenon. I mean, compassion may be a global phenomenon, but philanthropy in the way that we're describing it isn't really part of many cultural settings in the same way that it is in the West, which isn't to make ours better. It's just to say it's a different kind of vision. So what you're describing feels like it's an expression of a certain sort of technologist's approach to giving. And I'm just curious if you find any critique to that, or really, after doing it for all these years, it mostly just has such positive benefit that it doesn't seem worth critiquing particularly. I'm just curious.
Well, I think we do hear critique when people misunderstand and think that we're saying everyone should give this way, that this is how all giving should be done.
Yes.
All givers should fund technology. And that's not the case. I think what every donor, whether you're an individual or family or community or company, everyone should ask themselves, what am I passionate about? What do I know about? And how can I have a unique impact? And for Google, that's technology, but that's not going to be the answer for everybody. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not going to be the approach for everyone. And I think, you know, I'm very grateful that there's a lot of givers who, for example, you know, just write that check to a World Vision or a Compassion International every month and sponsor a child. Our family did that for more than 18 years. So I think that sort of steady funding of basic service provision is a big part of how we support the most vulnerable around the world. And not everything needs to be about innovation and technology. It's just that for Google, where we can have our unique value add is, I think, in that space.
So let me ask you this. If I was to crown you queen of the philanthropic universe today, and you could adjust and change how philanthropy is done corporately or personally, you occupy a role right now that gives you a very distinct globalized vision of the whole world and its needs and philanthropy's interaction with those needs. If you could control major shifts, what are the top three things, let's say, that you would want to control if you could shift everything in the direction that you think it should go?
Okay, that's very tempting. You should not wave a scepter in front of me.
Well, but you do already work for Google.org, so I feel like this is not wholly new territory, but
yeah.
Yes.
Well, I would say, I mean, number one, just starting in the corporate sector, I would say having companies realize that giving back, whether that's through financial commitments and or other ways that they can leverage who they are as a company, their people, their products, their supply chains, their reach, their brand, whatnot, how beneficial that is not only for the world, but for the company. So for example, at Google, what we know is it's so motivating for our employees to be able to work with Google.org and to know about the work of Google.org that it actually helps us with recruiting and it helps us with retention. So if you look at how many companies right now in the U.S. give back, if we had the companies just in the U.S. to give 1% the way that Google does, that would be an extra $60 billion a year going to nonprofits. Hmm. So one, it would be to just increase the number of companies that are giving and giving in serious ways.
Right.
I think as individuals and as families and as communities, it would be around data and really looking at effectiveness. And I think that we can all get sort of in love with the charity of the moment or with, I call it the cocktail party circuit, you know, the person who comes up to you or your friend is funding. And those efforts aren't bad or wrong. You know, they're totally fine. But I think we're not as rigorous when it comes to our giving as we are about other aspects. And so I think encouraging a culture where we're more honest with ourselves and with our friends and family and really asking questions about, well, what do you give to? And why do you give to them? And what do you like about them? And, well, what do you know about their track record? What makes you convinced that they're a strong player in the community? I think asking those kinds of questions rather than only responding to, well, so-and-so asked me to go to their gala benefit.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah.
I think would be important. And then I guess third would be really leaning into the most disadvantaged. And if you look at philanthropy in America and where we give, there is an awful lot of money going to, for example, institutions of higher education who already have multi-billion dollar endowments, right?
And just as a footnote, that would not mean Fuller Theological
Seminary.
That
would not be, yeah, exactly. I do not mean Fuller
Seminary.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just want to be sure that we're clear about that.
But, you know, thinking there's, I think, a desire to make sure that maybe that my alma mater, the place that I went or the place that I hope my kids go is well funded. And I think all that is well and good and, you know, nothing wrong with a portion of our giving, helping the symphony and art museums that cater mostly to the elite in our communities. But personally, I think that philanthropy should really serve disproportionately the poor and the disadvantaged and should really look at how can we help those who are left behind? How can we think about narrowing the opportunity gap? And what are the most effective ways to do that?
One of the things that is, I think, current in our culture right now is really a great deal of cultural skepticism about what sometimes gets typified as handouts. So what keeps philanthropy from being handouts as opposed to something that's transformational in the way that you're describing it?
You know, it's really funny you ask that, Mark, because I, like many people, really shared that bias and, you know, never, you know, give a man a fish, teach a man to fish kind of mentality, conventional wisdom. And one of my favorite investments that we have made is in a group called GiveDirectly, which is a nonprofit. And this group of PhD economists came to speak to us about this startup nonprofit that they had. And I listened to their pitch and then I was like, okay, wait, so you're telling me that the way that you are going to solve global poverty is by just giving poor people money? And they were like, yep, that's basically it. I was like, you are crazy. But then I looked at their data. And what's really interesting, Mark, is that people like me are in love with development and programs and measuring, you know, programs. And I think sometimes our elaborate programs are the best solution. You know, creating immunization campaigns for children is certainly a very high multiplier on your dollar invested. On the other hand, it is incredible the returns that you get when you give people with very, you know, strong work ethics who are temporarily cash poor, subsistence farmers in Kenya and Uganda, say, for example, and when you give them unrestricted cash. So what GiveDirectly does is they basically make it easy for someone in the general public to just send money to the mobile phone of someone who has been vetted as being poor and in need. And they've conducted randomized controlled trials, which are the gold standard of evaluation and not something we see enough of. And these randomized controlled trials show that giving people just unfettered cash, like here, Mark, you know, here's money for you to do with as you wish, actually increases outcomes in health and economics much more than many of our development programs. So I think that we need to be careful about conventional wisdom and what we think works and what we think doesn't, and really look at what the data tells us.
So going back to the Gates quote that all lives have equal value, more lives than we might imagine have equal capacity if they're given the right opportunity.
You know, as it turns out, Mark, a poor woman in Kenya with three children and farming mangoes actually knows better how to invest an extra, you know, $500 than me sitting in Silicon Valley in my conference room.
Right, right.
Now, certainly there are global public goods that we need to do, like drill wells and build schools and do immunization campaigns. But I think we could actually improve lives much more efficiently by transferring cash than the amount that's currently being done.
So if you were to give us one big warning about philanthropy, the state of philanthropy, if you gave us three suggestions of things that could be done that could make a positive difference. Philanthropy is not neutral. It's frequently been pointed out that it's problematically biased in certain ways. It can do great good, but it can also do harm. So what would be a warning that you might want to give us about how we should approach philanthropy?
I think you have to be really humble to be a good philanthropist. You have to really listen. You have to be willing to change your mind. You have to not look for silver bullets and really care more about impact than the credit, who gets the credit for something. I think when we follow those kind of basic rules, which are frankly the same kind of rules we learn in how to be a good person in kindergarten, that's when we're going to be most effective.
Right. And not just what we learned in kindergarten, but it goes back to what you were saying at the beginning about your own Christian faith leading you to the conviction that God really cares differentially about the poor.
Yeah.
So those sort of instincts that you're describing are part of an expression of that. As you look back on where you are now in light of your faith and these years of philanthropy, how does your faith now integrate with the things that you're doing?
Well, I think one of the nice things about being at Google and Google.org, and one of the filters that I look for before coming to join here, is Google.org before I joined had already said, you know, and had already been leaning into focusing on the most disadvantaged.
Right.
Sheryl Sandberg, for example, was one of the people who helped start Google.org before she went to Facebook. And she cares a lot about development and is very thoughtful about getting that on the agenda in the early years. And Google has also been very good about saying, Jacqueline, your job and your team's job is not to sell product or help the business. You know, just think about how to have the most impact possible. So that was kind of a filter, though, that I made sure was in place before I joined.
Yes.
And so that neatly aligned with my perspective and my faith and my desire to learn more about how to invest in local communities. I have a leader on one of my teams, Justin Steele, who encourages the team. You know, his line is get proximate, and really challenges us to get out of our bubbles and to get out of our privileged world, and to really make sure that we're learning and talking to folks who are on the front line, both helpers as well as beneficiaries. And so that also has been really aligned with, I think, what we learn in our faith about loving our neighbor and having that love not just be in a very esoteric way, but in a very pragmatic way.
You know, it's really wonderful when God takes a person's gifts and abilities and puts them in a context of such service as you've been given. And I know that I was joking about you having the ideal job and about the thought of you being queen of the philanthropic universe, which, as far as I'm concerned, by the way, would be just fine if you're ever offered that job. I would encourage you to take it. But I really have so appreciated what you've shared with us today and the substantial challenges and opportunities that exist in actually believing that financial resources and careful, thoughtful, humble giving can actually be a transformative influence in the world. And certainly that is a very key part of the human enterprise and also part of the distinctly Christian enterprise about how we understand what it means to be faithful, what it means to be loving and compassionate as we see our neighbors and engage and love one another. So, Jacqueline, thank you so much for the work that you're doing and for the way that you do bring your faith to bear on all this and for the unique universe that God's placed you in, which I'm just really, really thankful for. So thanks for today.
Thanks so much, Mark. Really appreciate it. And thanks to the work of Fuller Seminary to make our communities and our churches and our nation stronger.
Thank you so much. You've been listening to a production of Fuller Studio. Fuller Studio provides articles, podcasts, videos, and other resources for a deeply formed spiritual life. Subscribe on your favorite podcast app or visit us at fuller.edu/studio.